From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So how do you do? President Trump's State of the Union last night was 80 minutes long, second only to two of Bill Clinton's addresses. It spoke of a new American moment, showcased a vibrant country far different from the one he described in his inaugural. Frequently used words, America, American, and Americans.
Over the last year, the world has seen what we always knew. That no people on earth are so fearless or daring or determined as Americans. If there is a mountain, we climb it. If there's a frontier, we cross it. If there's a challenge, we tame it.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley is here. Scott, how are people reacting today?
Robin, would it surprise you to hear that the reaction has been mixed?
No.
Republicans are cheering the speech, and Democrats are throwing a lot of brickbats. While there were appeals to bipartisanship, at least verbal appeals in the president's speech, the substance of it was still pretty partisan, pretty divisive, and you can see that in the very different reviews it's getting from the two sides of the aisle.
But going in, you know, people on both sides said he does have, you know, things that he can claim after this first year. Let's listen to some of the president on the economy.
Small business confidence is at an all-time high. The stock market has smashed one record after another, gaining $8 trillion and more in value in just this short period of time.
And Scott, he went on to say, a biggest tax cuts ever, African-American unemployment at its lowest rate ever, wages are rising. The question for any first-year president is how much of the economy has to do with them or what was set in motion before. So just give an overview of the president's claims.
Well, it's interesting. The ABC Washington Post poll, which came out not long ago, did find very positive reviews for the economy. Nearly 6 in 10 Americans think the economy is either excellent or good. That's the best that rating's been in 17 years. But only about a third of those, or just over a third, gave the credit to President Trump. About half gave more credit to former President Obama. Job growth has actually slowed a little bit on this president's watch compared to the last year of Obama, which is not surprising because we're getting pretty close to full employment. The president talked about wage gains, but actually the wage picture has been pretty flat, 2.5% gain in 2017. Which is about what we've seen in recent years, and it's just a little bit ahead of inflation. Certainly, the stock market has been on a tear. That's great for people with stock savings, but that's only about half the American public. So it was a kind of a mixed bag. You know, in general, the economy is doing well, but it's hard to say that there's been a real inflection point under Donald Trump.
Well, people point to the claim of African-American unemployment at its lowest rate ever. It actually started dropping in 2010, dropped 9 points up until President Trump's first year and has dropped one more point since. So, you know, people seem to be looking at this as a continuum. Look, some of the reviews today are pointing out that the tone of last night didn't match the first year, the tone of the first year from the president.
Yeah, like I say, I think the tone, you could argue there were words that hinted at conciliation, but the substance was still pretty divisive, whether he was talking about criticism of the NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem or his immigration proposal, which is, you know, very, very controversial. It alienates some Republicans or some conservatives who don't like the path to citizenship for the so-called Dreamers, and it certainly irritates a lot of Democrats who don't like what would be deep cuts in legal family-based immigration.
And Scott, we have to ask you about news that we're seeing, and they're not great pictures on CNN. This is an Amtrak train carrying a number of Republicans, including, according to CNN leader Paul Ryan, to their retreat that they were headed towards from last night's speech. And apparently the train has hit a truck in Virginia. The truck.
That's right.
It's
an Amtrak train carrying really a lot of members of both the House and Senate on the GOP side on their way to a retreat in West Virginia, struck a truck that was on the train tracks. A lot of members who are on the train have been tweeting about this. It appears that no one has been seriously hurt. We should say that Republicans, because of geography, tend to be a little bit less favorable to funding Amtrak than their Democratic colleagues, and it's not likely that this will make any positive movement in that direction.
Well, we should say the pictures are kind of alarming. The truck did not seem to fare well, and so we'll continue to follow this story over the course of the day. Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Well, the president made a pitch for infrastructure spending last night, $1.5 trillion worth, but most of that money would not come from the federal government.
Every federal dollar should be leveraged by partnering with state and local governments and, where appropriate, tapping into private sector investment to permanently fix the infrastructure deficit, and we can do it.
Joining us now is Ray LaHood, a former Republican member of Congress who was the Secretary of Transportation under President Obama. Secretary LaHood, the Trump administration is expected to propose an infrastructure spending package of about $200 billion and try to leverage the rest of that money. Will that work?
Probably not, Jeremy. The idea that the president is proposing more than $1 trillion is important because that kind of leadership is needed in order to raise the money. The idea that $200 billion will leverage that, probably, you know, the math just doesn't work there because there's just not enough private dollars or other public dollars out there, and that's the dilemma, and it will be up to Congress, obviously, to find the money to try and get the $1.5 trillion. I obviously have some ideas. Maybe we can talk about how we get to the $1.5 trillion.
But you're basically saying that $1.5 trillion is a good number. They might not get there, but $200 billion wouldn't be enough to deal with what the nation needs on infrastructure.
Yeah, look, we have 60,000 structurally deficient bridges in the country right now. The interstates are crumbling. You have 50 to 60 to 70-year-old transit systems all over America that are in need of equipment, whether it's infrastructure or cars, and we need a lot of money. There's no question about it. The one thing the president said, which was good, which is important, is it needs to be done in a bipartisan way. And certainly transportation has always been bipartisan. There are no Republican or Democratic bridges, and there are no Republican or Democratic roads. When I was in Congress, we passed 2 6-year bills, and it was very bipartisan. And it can be that way again, and particularly with the leadership from the White House, it certainly could be that way.
One of the other concerns that has come up today, and Paul Krugman writes about it in the New York Times, is that if you bring in all this private investment, you may end up with a lot more private toll roads and toll bridges, and it becomes infrastructure for the rich.
Yeah, look, if you invest in infrastructure, what you're investing in is not only roads, bridges, transits, programs, and so forth, but you're investing in the American people. The people that build infrastructure right now are the highest segment of unemployment in America today. They're the building trades. They're people that build roads, build bridges. These people need work. You know, the idea that everybody's going to benefit from the tax cut, you got to be working first before you can pay taxes. And a lot of people that build roads and bridges are not working because we've had an inadequate amount of money funding our infrastructure. So if the Congress can figure out a way to pay for this, they're going to be investing in workers all over America for the money that goes in their pockets when they're building roads and bridges.
So you said you had some ideas on that.
I do. What I've been talking about is raising the gas tax, which hasn't been raised in the last 25 years. The last time it was raised is 1993. You create opportunities for tolling in the states that don't have it. You create an infrastructure bank. President Obama proposed a $50 million infrastructure bank. Use that money to leverage. You create public-private partnerships. You create maybe some pilot programs for vehicle miles traveled. Those five pots of money, if they are created, you create a huge pot of money for opportunities to leverage against the federal share. And let me just add one other thing. In the last 3 years, 25 states have increased their own gas tax. Some very conservative states, Utah, Wyoming, Iowa, Virginia. These states, almost all of them are controlled by Republican legislators and Republican governors. And nobody's been thrown out of office because people get it. They see the gas tax going up, and then they see their friends and neighbors building roads and bridges. So politicians should really take their cues from what the states have been doing, and then you create the kind of opportunity to really rebuild America.
What about something else President Trump talked about last night, which is that he wants to streamline the permitting process, get it down to no more than 2 years and perhaps even one? Is that possible?
It is possible, Jeremy. I think what they could look at is what we did during the Obama years. We streamlined the permitting process. It can be done. Look, you don't want to compromise safety. But the answer is you can streamline it by just telling the federal agencies, do the kind of reviews simultaneously rather than waiting 2 or 3 years till one department does it, then another department. And we did some of that. The answer is yes, it's a good idea. It's a very good recommendation.
That's Ray LaHood, who was Secretary of Transportation from 2009 to 2013 under President Obama. Secretary LaHood, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Tonight, FX airs the third episode of The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story. It tells the story of the fashion designer who was gunned down on the front steps of his Miami Beach home in 1997. The man who murdered Versace, Andrew Cunanan, had killed four other men in the months prior. The show is the latest season of American Crime Story, a follow-up to last year's The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And joining us now are two of the executive producers who worked on both seasons, Nina Jacobson and Brad Simpson of the film and TV production company Color Force. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And first of all, what drew you to this story, the murder of Gianni Versace, for the new season of American Crime Story?
When we first got involved with Ryan Murphy, we had developed a People versus O.J. Simpson as a standalone season of television. And he transformed our one season into the first season of an ongoing anthology, which is now American Crime Story. And very early on in the process, he had said that he wanted to tell the story of Andrew Cunanan and Gianni Versace. And Brad and I at that time didn't actually know very much except for the big headlines. And that we just didn't know very much about the rest of the story, which was that there had been four victims prior to
right.
Versace, that it was the largest failed manhunt in the history of the FBI. And for me, I didn't know very much at all about actually what a trendsetter, both culturally and in terms of sort of the social politics of being out, that Versace was at the time. And so there was a lot of learning for us, but Ryan was the one who said, we've got to do it as a season.
Well, and Brad, how difficult is it to approach a story like this, which is about real people and real events, and still be sensitive to how painful and shocking the murder, not just of Versace, but the other people that Nina just mentioned, Jeffrey Trail, David Madsen, Lee Miglin, William Reese, how difficult those were?
You know, we think about the victims a lot when we're making these shows, and I think any ethical producer of something that's dealing with true crime or any true story has to always remember that there's real people at the center of it and real pain. And I can't pretend that by doing the show, we don't revisit that pain for the people out there. We think it's important to do the shows because they're about more than just the murders. They're usually about something that is bigger in American culture. And the murder of Gianni Versace really was a way for us to explore the politics of being out and being gay in the 1990s and to ask this question of why this culture of celebrity assassination exists in the United States. I think that one of the ways this show is different from The People versus O.J. Simpson is that the O.J. Simpson show we did was about the trial and it was really about the lawyers. And this show is a lot more about the victims. It's about who these people were that Andrew killed and the sort of injustice of their deaths.
It's also, though, about Andrew Cunanan, played by Darren Criss in this show. And let's listen to a clip from the show. Here he is talking with Gianni Versace, played by Edgar Ramirez, after the opening night of the opera Capriccio, which Versace designed the costumes for in San Francisco back in 1990.
For me, family is everything. Everything. Mm. The first dress I ever made was for my sister Donatella. Maybe every dress I make is for her.
That makes me want to cry.
Makes me smile.
Yes, well, that too. Yeah, of course.
His performance is just incredible. I mean, he just lies constantly, and you can see it as a viewer.
He lies so much that I think he does not know his own truth very well. And as the show goes backwards in time, to his origins. You see where those habits began. He lies so much that he eventually finds himself completely alone because nobody really knows who he is, because he's a different person with everyone.
The series is based on the book Vulgar Favors by Vanity Fair contributor Maureen Orth, and she and her publisher, Random House, stand by her reporting on this. But the Versace family and Versace's partner, Gianni Versace's partner, have criticized the series and said it doesn't reflect reality. How do you respond to that?
You know, this is not an authorized piece about the Versace family in the same way that, you know, the O.J. Simpson series wasn't authorized. We've done the same thing with this series, which is to base it on a book by an incredibly well-respected journalist. Maureen has been a senior writer at Vanity Fair for 20 years. You know, there's some things in the book the Versace family doesn't like, but it's a thoroughly researched book that's been in print for close to 20 years now. And, you know, we very much tried to do right by Gianni Versace. We think that he was a genius.
Well, one of the things that the family doesn't like is that is the implication in here that he had HIV. Are you confident that he was HIV positive based on what you've learned about the story?
Well, Maureen certainly says in her book, she states as a fact that Gianni Versace was HIV positive at the time of his death. She talked to people who knew him. She also talked to a detective who saw the autopsy report. You know, this was a time in which HIV was still a death sentence. It was killing thousands and thousands of gay men. And we personally don't think that there's any stigma anymore to having HIV. I can understand why it would be sensitive to the family. I think what's important for us is that Gianni Versace had been really sick and he suddenly had gotten better. And it was like a miracle. And Andrew came in at this moment and took his life just as Gianni was starting to enjoy the benefits of what we believe are the retroviral drugs.
One of the things we discovered in researching this story is actually how little has been written about Versace as a man, about QAnon and the victims who came before. Maureen was one of the most, probably the most dogged reporter who was following QAnon before he had even gotten to Miami. But we also have, you know, a tragic situation where most of the people whose stories are being told are not—they're not here to tell us more. And so there is some degree of imagination that has to go into creating a story like this. And certainly for us, the stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS, the shame that was being experienced by so many gay people who were still living in the closet, the fact that the investigation was in part bungled because of the disconnect between law enforcement and the gay community, all of these sort of notions go into our imagining of what we can't know for sure and can only draw on the research that was available to us and then, say, sort of use thematic intent to shape where we go from there.
I want to listen to one more clip from the show. This is Penelope Cruz, who plays Donatella Versace, Gianni's sister, who became the brand Versace's chief designer after his murder.
As you know, my brother, who I love very much, is dead. And now the press and the police will wreck through his life. Every rumor, every indiscretion. They'll judge the killer, yes, but they'll judge the victim too. First people weep, then they whisper.
Then they whisper, getting to the point we were talking about earlier. As you shot this, what was the most complicated thing about it?
You know, I think that the thing that was most complicated about shooting was that we were shooting in the actual house that Versace had assembled. We were shooting on the steps where he died. His house was right on the street. He was incredibly accessible, and that accessibility, that love of other people is what got Versace killed. And he created this artistic haven in this house. Edgar, Penelope, Ricky, Ryan, Nina, and I were all really taken with what it meant to be recreating a man's death in the place that it happened. And you could feel him in the house. And it had a huge effect on everybody and weighed on everybody.
Nina?
Well, I think also, you know, for us, the clip that you've just played and some of the things that Donatella says, which is that, you know, she would not let her brother be murdered twice, that she would not let his reputation be murdered. It was something that we thought about quite a bit, and that for us, this show is actually an opportunity to explore a man who, you know, is known mostly just by his brand name, but not as a human being. There was a weight, I think, for us of, you know, to not be guilty ourselves of some of the crimes that we're trying to explore.
Will there be another American Crime Story after this one?
Absolutely.
Do you know who it's going to be about?
Originally, the second season of American Crime Story was going to be about Hurricane Katrina. And we were getting close to going into production, and we looked at what we had, and we felt that it didn't have the intimacy or the focus on character that would allow us to best tell the story. And so we rebooted. We had our Versace scripts already chugging along, and we felt that they were ready to go. And so we are back at work now on Katrina, working off of Sherry Fink's book, 5 Days at Memorial, and trying to tell the story of Katrina through a more intimate, character-based lens that's a microcosm for the larger events outside.
That's Nina Jacobson, and we've been speaking also with Brad Simpson, executive producers of The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story. The third episode airs tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Last night, President Trump applauded the FDA for approving a record number of drugs. He also called on Congress to pass a bill that would give terminally ill patients access to experimental treatments. It's called the Right to Try Bill. It's stalled in Congress, and the head of the FDA is concerned it undermines his agency's authority to okay drugs. Ike Swetlitz is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT. Ike, tell us more about what this bill would do.
So this bill would enable patients who are suffering from terrible diseases access to medical treatments that are still under the process of study or review. So, you know, maybe it's still in the process of clinical trials. It hasn't yet made it onto the market, but maybe it's worked for some of those patients in the trials, and some people think that other patients should be able to benefit from it.
And the patients obviously sign off any liability. They're the ones who want it.
Yes, and it's and I, there's some disagreement right now in terms of exactly which patients should be able to access it, and that's a little bit of a nuance that didn't really come up in the president's speech. The phrase terminally ill patients that he used is a little different than the phrase that's in the actual bill, which is a patient with a life-threatening illness. And Scott Gottlieb at the FDA has said that this is a much broader category, this life-threatening illness, and maybe shouldn't be that broad.
Well, and you're mentioning Scott Gottlieb, the Food and Drug Administration commissioner, who has been a little more hesitant about this bill because, as you said, there's a huge difference between something that's life-threatening and something that has threatened your life. It's going to end it. It's a terminal illness. So he's concerned that it's going to be too broad. But it appears that his new boss, Alex Azar, who was sworn in on Monday as head of Health and Human Services, is more interested in this legislation.
Well, so I was, you know, I was sitting right above the president during the speech and was focusing very intently on Alex Azar's expression, and he seemed excited at what the president said. So we'll have to see how it plays out. And the bill's, you know, still in committee, so there are still changes that could happen to it, and we're watching that very closely.
Well, you were there, so you heard the president also vow to bring down the price of prescription drugs. Let's listen.
In many other countries, these drugs cost far less than what we pay in the United States, and it's very, very unfair. That is why I've directed my administration to make fixing the injustice of high drug prices one of my top priorities for the year.
Ike Swetlitz, we know that drug costs are higher in different countries for different reasons. Countries have taxes. Some countries' governments mandate price controls. Here, the drug industry frequently says that money goes into research and development so they can have lower drug costs elsewhere. But what are the challenges? I mean, the U.S. wants the industry to come up with a solution. What's the thinking that Azar, who comes from the drug industry, can do this?
One of the big challenges is that all of the different players in the industry have slightly different financial incentives. We've seen that play out in Congress over the past year with different interest groups, you know, maybe taking some of the responsibility, but also pointing fingers at other people, and they haven't, you know, come up with a solution together. Something that I'm really excited to hear more from Alex Azar about is an idea he floated about incentivizing drug companies to lower the list price of their drugs. That's something that Alex Azar did not do while he was at Lilly. He's come under criticism for the list price of insulin increasing while he was there. So it's going to be exciting to see what ideas he has to do that.
That's Ike Swetlitz, Washington correspondent for STAT. Ike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Trump voters now on last night's State of the Union. Kim Dowdle is from Birmingham, Alabama, a stay-at-home mom. She agrees with President Trump on many things, but not his backing of candidate Roy Moore in the election there. Kim's given us permission to say she is a rape survivor. And after several women accused Moore of sexual assault, she co-founded the group Republicans for Doug Jones, the Democrat who won that Senate seat. But Kim, what did you make of President Trump's State of the Union?
Overall, I was pleased. I was very pleased that he controlled himself.
Well, you've told us that's the one thing you do, take the phone out of his hand.
Oh, yeah, I would. I mean, let's be honest. We all voted for him because he wasn't a politician. And I do enjoy his opinions, find them comical at times. But there are times where he just needs to stop.
Well, last night was apparently one. I mean, the president is getting kudos for staying on script, for having a more civil tone than he can have on Twitter. But you told us that you wanted to hear about immigration. You are of Irish and Italian background. Your brother's wife just got her citizenship. She's from the Philippines. What'd you want to hear? And did you hear it?
I mean, there's so much that goes in with immigration. I just want to see America create an honest path for those who truly want to become citizens. I'm not talking about those who are here and don't pay taxes. I'm talking about my sister-in-law who came here as a young child, and her family worked hard and was diligent. She's a nurse. She went through our universities, and she's good at what she does. She pays taxes. She has five beautiful children with my brother. She's not going anywhere. Her family is all over here now. Those are the people that I want to see have a definite pathway. And he did say 12 years last night, which I was proud to hear at least some date. That's ridiculous, in my opinion, 12 years. But it's a start.
Well, there is a deadline for lawmakers to figure that out, so that was one concern. Tell me, was there a moment where you kind of winced, or a moment where you sat up and said, this is what I want to hear from my president?
There weren't any wince moments, with the exception, he spoke about prison reform, and I liked what he said, but what I didn't like was how. He said that he wants to reform our prisoners to help inmates who have served their time to get a second chance at life, and I give him accolades for that, but how?
I'm just curious, why is that so important to you? Why did that hit home? The idea of helping prisoners have work after their sentences end.
Well, our prison system is so broken, and we put these people in jail, and, you know, you can change. Everyone can change. But if you've got someone in prison who is really earnest in their desire to change, then all we do when we release him is just give him a little bit of money and say good luck, you know?
How did you feel about the fact that he pivoted off of that to linking crime in the U.S. to these MS-13 gangs, which are horrendous, but often are not really representative of most immigrants?
You're right there. It does infuriate me that people like the MS-13 gangs are the greater representative of those who are just here trying to just make ends meet and become a citizen of this amazing country. They want freedom just like everyone else, just like my forefathers and yours.
Yeah. You've, again, given us permission to mention that you are a rape survivor.
Yes.
What do you think of the women who have made so many accusations against President Trump?
You know, here's what I'd like to see him do. And if he would just do this, how much more revered he would be. And I don't think he understands that, actually. Perhaps he just needs to hear that, that we as Americans would revere him for his faults as well as his strengths, you know? I would love for him to actually say, I did this. I passed it off as locker room talk. It made me nervous. I didn't know what to say. I didn't expect it to be taped. I felt violated because it was taped. And because I felt violated that it was taped, now I understand a wee bit of just how much they must have felt violated that I did those deplorable actions to them. Hmm. Do I believe them? You bet I do.
You do, Kim. You believe
I do.
It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's Kim Dowdle, a Republican voter from Birmingham, Alabama. Kim, thanks so much for weighing in on the speech last night.
Thank you for having me.
So she's a rape survivor who's for a second chance for inmates. And as we just heard, the president, a Republican for a path to citizenship. Interesting. Now to Ben Clymer, Jr., president of the Lincoln Club of Riverside County, California. He was a delegate for candidate Trump during the 2016 National Convention. He's also a small business owner, runs several auto body repair shops. Ben, your take on the State of the Union last night.
Overall, in regards to the State of the Union, I was fairly satisfied with the message from President Trump, and I thought it, contrary to some of the media comments afterward, I thought it was an overall unifying message.
Well, and how so? What did you hear?
One thing that in particular was very unifying was when he talked about his four-point plan for immigration. He specifically mentioned it wasn't something that individuals were going to get 100% of what they wanted, but that everyone would get something, and it was compromise.
And the pillars are, as we heard when this was laid out, a path to citizenship for the DACA recipients and the Dreamers, reduce what's called family immigration or chain migration by some, eliminating the visa lottery, and secure the border. So you liked hearing that, in particular because you've told us your wife is a Mexican immigrant who came to the U.S. legally 20 years ago, and you and she are not comfortable with people granted citizenship if they came illegally.
That's correct. As the president alluded to last night, American citizens, we have dreams too. And what we see, my wife and I both, is it's a blatant disrespect and a slap in the face to those individuals who took the time to come here legally to let these other individuals come and cut in front of the line, so to speak.
Well, and does that even apply in your mind to children who had no choice?
The parents put them in that situation. But let's look at what DACA even stands for. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which means it would have to be addressed at a later time. Congress has the authority to implement immigration laws, not the president. Trump put it back in the hands of Congress, which is the constitutional method.
So you're satisfied there. And by the way, if in fact the president's plan goes through, these DACA recipients would not just get deferred deportation, they would have a path to citizenship. Are you okay with that?
It would depend on the path. For example, all the individuals that are currently in the queue, if their path is after the total queue is satisfied, I wouldn't be necessarily an objection to that. If they get to the front of the line, I think that would dissatisfy a lot of his base.
Okay. Well, you're a businessman. Just real quick, what did you hear that you liked about business and the economy?
Seeing that companies are reinvesting in America. During the campaign, the rhetoric we heard from the Democratic side was that bolstering manufacturing jobs would be impossible in the United States. And now seeing that manufacturing is re-ramping up, extremely encouraging. Unemployment, the lowest it's been in over four decades. That's extremely encouraging.
But how do you feel about the president claiming those stats when, in fact, it's been a trend for years?
So the trend for the years that we heard from the prior president, who also inherited a bad economy from his predecessor, mm-hmm. was this is the new norm when quoting statistics like 1.8% growth GDP and 2% growth GDP. Now that we see over 3% GDP, something has to be working, right? And there is more faith in the direction the country is taking when it comes to the economy.
So overall, what would you give the president? Grade him, Ben.
For his speech last night, overall, I would grade him an A. There are some things I obviously disagree with as far as being very militaristic in foreign intervention. I'd like to see more of his platform as far as the non-intervention. But overall, I really like the fact that he touched on what, after all, is our motto, in God we trust, and faith in family, not in government, being the center of the American life.
And by the way, you've told us you're a flaming libertarian, your words.
I am indeed.
And so you did not like the request for more funding for the military.
No, only because we need to know what's being spent first, especially with Trump being a businessman, for him to follow through on wanting to audit the different departments to make them more accountable prior to just granting more funding. Because I think we could have an even more effective military with what is being spent now, let alone more.
That's Ben Clymer Jr., president of the Lincoln Club of Riverside County, California, a Republican independent organization. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Dozens of political parties are lining up for the next election in Zimbabwe. This vote will be the first since the ouster of the country's longtime leader, Robert Mugabe, last November. Mugabe was replaced by Emmerson Mnangagwa. He went to Davos last week and delivered a message similar to the one delivered by President Trump. He said Zimbabwe is open for business. Joining us now is the BBC's Shingai Nioka in the capital, Harare. And Shingai, after all those years with Mugabe in charge, what are things like now in Zimbabwe?
Well, I don't think anybody expected that things would turn around, given the fact that it's taken almost 20 years for the economy to decline to where it is now, where there's more than 90% unemployment, where there are cash shortages. Zimbabwe doesn't use its own currency anymore. It uses the United States dollar. And so economically speaking, the situation has been very dire. But on the street, what we've seen is optimism. For example, because Emmerson Mnangagwa went to Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. He's the first Zimbabwean head of state to do so. So there's really a lot of optimism that he put across the right message and that international investment will start to trickle in and turn things around here.
And he's promised to crack down on corruption in Zimbabwe. Has he taken any steps to do that?
Well, he took steps almost as soon as he came into power. One of the first things he did was to order an amnesty of 3 months. Essentially, what he's done is he's given a three-month window for people who have externalized money. He says that he knows who some of those people are, that he has a list. And so they have essentially a window period to bring back money, no questions asked, and they won't be tried. So that's one of the major steps that he's taken. A few weeks ago, he also told his ministers that he wanted an asset declaration, and they've also been given 2 weeks to do that. But what we've seen so far is there was a lot of corruption in Zimbabwe, especially among political figures within the ruling party. We've seen only those that were allied to Grace Mugabe, who's the former first lady, arrested and prosecuted. What Zimbabweans are waiting to see now is whether he will take a tough stance against members of his own cabinet who are alleged to be corrupt.
I saw that there is some hope among white farmers in Zimbabwe that they might get some of their land back, which was taken away after Mugabe took power.
One farmer returned to his farm that was soon after President Emmerson Mnangagwa took over, but we understand that he had been illegally taken off his plot by a member of one of the critics of Emmerson Mnangagwa. He's been very clear and has said that the white farmers, yes, they will be able to come back to farm, but they won't have the huge tracts of land that they had before. He says that the dispensation has changed and the landowner ownership rules have changed, and that they will have to apply like everybody else for 99-year leases. What the government has also committed to do is to pay compensation and have hinted that they might even set up a tribunal to try to estimate how much is owed to these white farmers. But everybody knows that the government does not have any money. It's already started to compensate some companies, but the farmers put the ballpark figure at $15 billion US dollars, and it's really not conceivable believable that Zimbabwe will be able to pay that amount of money. And so there's a lot of horse trading behind the scenes about whether the white farmers will be able to accept a smaller tract of land in exchange for compensation.
Does Robert Mugabe still have support among Zimbabweans?
Well, if he does, nobody is saying so. You saw the scenes in November last year where thousands of people poured out onto the streets celebrating that he'd left. He has a few allies, former ministers that were ousted along with him, and they still maintain that this coup is illegal. But most Zimbabweans have decided to move on, as has the rest of the world, including the European Union and the American government.
And the next election, has it been scheduled yet? And are there concerns about violence during the campaign?
Emmerson Mnangagwa has hinted that those elections will be held before July. Constitutionally speaking, the government has up until July, August to call these elections. He has said that that they will come early, and he's also promised that they'll be free and they'll be fair and that the international community will be allowed in to observe them. The European Union, as well as the Western countries, were not allowed to come in or observe elections under President Robert Mugabe. We have yet to see whether those elections will be violence-free. The opposition has said that they have other concerns. For example, the voters' roll. Zimbabwe is in the process of putting together a completely new voters' roll. They say that there's still potential to manipulate that roll. They want access to the public media, which at this stage is very biased towards the ruling party. And so the issues of free and fair election are not just about violence, but also access and creating a level playing field for the opposition.
That's the BBC's Shingai Nyoka joining us from Harare in Zimbabwe. Shingai, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.